Hall. Members present, Representative Davis, Representative Cato, Representative Ellis, myself. Today we have three resolutions scheduled here. I don't know if we're gonna get through them all or not, we're gonna try. We're here in order of House Track Resolution 28, which is Representative Davis and Bill. And we're here as Senator Yuri Bill and ACR 28, we'll get to it. After we hear Davis and Bill, I think Dr. Gary Anders is going to be here. He needs about 20 minutes to, we're going to give him 20 minutes to read his presentation to us. I'm hoping to schedule another meeting on March 23rd here from Paul Hughes, Mayor of Alaska, who's agreed to come and give us a presentation as to what they're doing, what their ambitions are in international trade arena. And we'll see if we can schedule another meeting between now and 23rd and here, if we can hear today. We don't get to all these three resolutions. We'll cut off the phone last, Representative Davis, ready.
Thank you, Chairman. When you started off, I thought you were gonna say you were gonna take these orders and fulfill the order of importance, and I was appreciating your endorsement for the importance of this resolution. But seriously, the resolution's a pretty straightforward resolution. Basically what it does is, you all have maps, it sets up an area between Alaska and Russia, establishment of a biosphere, and that area is called, let's see if I can pronounce it right, Beringia, and it recognizes the importance of that area. There's a number of biospheres. I have a map up here all around the world, designated biospheres, to important areas of study. I don't know how many of them, but they're scattered throughout the world. They're an entity that's established by UNESCO. And what, let me just give you a definition of a biosphere.
Are each the colors of different biospheres?
No, these are biospheres, but within each of these designated areas, there's little dots, and these are designated biospheres. There's a whole series, and they're all over the world. They're just unique areas, and I'll give you the definition of a biosphere. A biosphere is the symbol of voluntary cooperation to conserve and use the resources for the well-being of people everywhere. And we have a unique opportunity here in this area between Alaska and Russia is an area that, of course, was once tied together in a land bridge, but today is an area where we have not only peoples that travel back and forth between those two areas, but we also have migratory animals traveling between there. We have a lot, both of us on both sides of the border are doing exploratory drilling of wells, so there's a lot of information that, scientific information that can be shared, as well as cultural information as far as the native peoples. So what this is a indication of support by the legislature to work towards the establishment of this biosphere. As I said, this biosphere is part of a global network of biospheres that are found throughout the world. Trying to answer any questions. It is a pretty straightforward resolution. It pretty much tells the importance of the area and just what we're trying to achieve here.
Chair, what are we doing on the establishment of biosphere? Are there restrictions or anything like that?
No, there's not. It's not. It's just draws attention to the importance of the area. It's sort of an overlay of this area. Ask for and request cooperative efforts in terms of research between two countries, but it doesn't provide any restrictions as far as the existing use of land.
Representative Ellis?
Well, to follow up on Representative Jacko's question on page 2, line 8, it says, whereas local people benefit from biosphere reserves from protection of basic resources. If there is no additional overlay of protection, this may lead some people to believe on the floor of the House. I mean, we may get into a tussle with a debate here, and resources are on the floor of the House. If people are led by this sentence to believe that there is some additional overlay of protections of the resources beyond what already exists. So we might consider clarifying that sentence. I see it being, some people being concerned about that. And then my second question is on page one, line 24, it says, whereas this natural heritage program has been proposed. Was it proposed at this most recent exchange between the Soviets and Alaskans or in a previous get-together?
Not really. There's been work done by people, private individuals that are working on making this a designated biosphere, getting that designated, but wasn't in any of the discussions. We try to have this introduced in recognition of the fact that the people were coming from the Monument. They haven't had any ongoing discussions between like the governor and...
So no official proposal, it's just people have been talking about it.
Right. Okay. Not in terms of government circles, that's correct.
Representative Davis, the actual area of the biosphere is exactly where? Is it the narrow area between above Nome and above Providentia, where you have a black line?
Well, it's...
Or is it all the Bering Sea?
Well, it's a good question. It's just this general area.
That's what I wanted to know.
Here, the Bering Straits.
This map doesn't have either little diameter or big diameter on it, does it?
No, I think, President Cato, that right there, I believe, is big diameter.
Oh, okay.
Probably little diameter right next to
it. Okay, I was wondering if that's what it was. It wasn't labeled. Yeah. In other words, then, we're talking about the area that has to do with the Bering Straits and where what we assume was a land bridge many years ago.
Exactly.
Not the entire Bering Sea, including the Aleutians and the Kamchatka.
No.
Just that it'll probably help to build along by the time this gets to the floor to have a more exact geographic description, because you know there have been all those controversies about the islands and that group that always writes to us fighting over the various islands and whether it's the Soviets or the Americans that have jurisdiction. So to avoid all of that kind of controversy, you might want to have a shaded map and with some sort of longitude and latitude.
Take a look on page two. It talks about the area existing of the
land bridge.
On page 21, land and already existing no attack and Bering Land Bridge National Preserve which serves as a land base for the left side of the biosphere reserve. I believe it's fairly defined already, but we can.
It might help if you're going to circulate a map to have it.
Okay, that's an excellent point. I'll do that. Is there any suggestions, Mr. Chairman, as far as language here? We can.
Well, I have to agree with Ellis that this protection here on page two give the implication that they're going to have a later regulation of potential something like that. It might cause some problems. I'm not sure exactly what the deal is.
How about protection of...
Can you strike the word protection altogether? Protection of natural resources.
Well, just protection of existing. How about protection of existing resources? Because I don't think we're talking about...
Well, I think our main problem is the word protection. Or you think that would cause some problems?
Well, no. Actually, I don't, Mr. Chairman, because any activity that's proposed, any let's say oil and gas activities, are always they're trying to do that in conjunction with the existing resources, whales or when they have causeways built, they try to protect the existing resources. So perhaps it would be better instead of protection of the basic resources, but protection of the existing resources. Because one of the things that certainly under study on the North Slope is what happens when we build causeways, and there's a lot of study to make sure that when a causeway is built, there's enough escaping so that the existing resources are protected. So that kind of shared information between the Soviet Union and Alaska could work to protect the existing resources.
And then also that come into concerns if you change that. The protection of basic resources and protecting existing resources. What is the word protection then?
It's more protection. if we're talking about existing protections or some implied new protection, I think it's really, well, what I was...
That's my recommendation, Mr. Chairman. I'd move that we strike basic resources and put in existing resources, protect some existing resources. I think that's generally the thrust of any Arctic development is that existing resources are afforded protection.
Mr. Chairman, I maybe Representative Davis and I are connected here, but yeah, my concern isn't about existing resources or future resources, or it's just about what whether this will lead people to believe that there are additional protections on the fisheries or mineral resources or or whatever. For example, the United States never signed the Law of the Sea Treaty, worked out in all kinds of bilateral arrangements among various countries in the United Nations. And because the United States was concerned about a limitation on our ability to mine the sea bottom or the seabed for strategic minerals and things. And so, since this is an international agreement that deals with a marine environment, I don't know enough about, you know, I've never served on the Resources Committee, so I'm sort of limited here in my knowledge of exactly what would be the appropriate thing to do. But I just think the resolution will have trouble if people get the idea that with this resolution we're somehow enacting or implying our support for additional protections. Maybe we are, but I'm just saying it should be clear.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think you might have been on the room, but a lot of the proposed development of the Arctic is done in conjunction with gathering information to protect existing resources. So I think that would, whether it's building causeways, to do a lot of research to make sure the causeways are minimize the existing resources, protect an existing resources, or movement of the whales.
I just bring my point, sir, and I don't oppose the...
I have a tendency to agree with what the developer is saying, that if we, I think the intent, it seems to me like what the intent is to do with this resolution is drawing attention to this area as a biosphere, and if we put some protection in there, I think we're going to get into the debate of locking up another area, maybe it's not exactly doing that.
Everyone.
It implies that.
Mr. Chairman, could you tell me what the recommendation is coming from? What's your proposal, Mike?
My proposal is, I think that we need to all kind of whole paragraph, I could be wrong, just for me, but to protection of basic resources, to just delete that and put existing resources.
Basic resources to existing resources?
Right. Because it still talks about productive...
through the chair to Jenny Ellis. Jenny, are you worried about the word protection, where it might indicate that certain things wouldn't happen because existing resources were being protected? Is that what's bugging you? Or you get what I'm saying there?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, if there are some constraints, which there are not, am I correct?
Yeah. Representative Cato, I don't think it's such a big deal. I just wanted to raise the concern because it's a whereas. It's not,
yeah,
if it
right.
were, if the word protection were in the resolve, it would be a big issue, but since we're just referencing that the resources in that area are currently protected, I don't think it's such a big idea. I'm just speaking to the general point of clarity in this resolution so that it passes.
Yeah, I see.
Representative Davis, if you want that change to existing or basic, we can change it to existing. That's fine, but personally, I really don't. I would need to get a motion to change it if we need to do that. I think that was necessary, but the way it reads, the basis is probably wrong.
All right. Well, I'll renew my amendment.
Any more questions or comments?
If we have no more questions on it, I would move to pass out House Joint Resolution number 28 with individual recommendations.
Any objections? Hearing none, HJR 28 is so moved. Right now, we're going to break from the resolutions and hear a presentation by Dr. Gary Anders. Are you ready? Well, I'd like to know for the record that Representative Hodgson is trying to see.
Good morning.
Oh, and also I'd like to know that Representative Anders, 51, right? Very well.
Did you want me to give a presentation, Mr. Chairman, now or come back later?
Well, we're going to hear about Dr. Gary Anders, if he's on the time constraint also.
Okay, great, okay.
Chairman Jeffco, thank you very much for making the time to hear my presentation. I will be referring to this document, which is a draft of a program for a conference I'm organizing. So we're working with this while you're looking at all the selected two gentlemen that are accompanying me. This is Mr. Patrick Anderson. He's the director of the Alaska Economic Development Center at the University of Alaska Southeast. And Mr. Dutch Knight, who's the president of the Student Association at the University and also a student of my international business class. Thank you. The purpose of my presentation is to inform the committee about a conference which will be taking place here in June, April 17th, 18th, and 19th in Centennial Hall. The conference is sponsored under a grant from the Japan-U.S. Friendship Commission. The grant was written by Mr. Anderson and myself, utilizing our contacts through the Fulbright organization and also through Alaska Kyokai, which is a umbrella organization of interested parties in Hokkaido that have some long-standing interest in Alaska. The program is a very general one in the sense that we are inviting over a group of speakers that come from three principal institutions in northern Japan. They are the university, which includes Hokkaido University and Hakusei Gakuin University, various agencies in the prefectural and the metropolitan government, and then several large companies. We've tried to match those representatives with a group of Alaskan speakers in a conference setting that would allow the presentation and exchange of information on various areas of trade policy and economic development policy. At the same time, we have some assurance from the Hokkaido delegation that they'll be bringing over a number of other interested parties affiliated through their economic federation and government, and that they are coming to Alaska to find out what kinds of things, what kind of development opportunities, and what kind of exchanges are possible. All the Japanese speakers have been confirmed. We've only had a couple of cancellations. On Tuesday, we have not been able to secure Mr. Lockheimer, who unfortunately is going to be in Europe. Mr. Lockheimer is, I think, one of the first Americans to ever be appointed to the board of directors for a major multi-billion-dollar company in Japan. And one of the items for consideration is to try to find out what interest this committee has so that we might be able to arrange for a guest speaker at that time that would be appropriate for your business as well as ours. The program also includes education and cultural exchanges, and we've been very fortunate to get a number of leading Japanese influence brokers in this area as well. And we have been almost satiated with requests for information from educators throughout the state. But our principal focus is really in two areas. One is the economic policies that are pursued in Japan's northern frontier. In other words, presentations of how they have gone through various economic cycles and have forced a new future for themselves, and how they communicate that to the state of Alaska, because it does have an impact upon our markets and our access to their country and their economy. Another possibility is joint ventures, and we're very fortunate to have representatives from the Hakushu Shoku Bank, which is a real mouthful, and they have as much money as they do syllables, and they're interested in looking at the financial structure of Alaska. These institutions, which are going to be presenting papers, I think really form the bridgehead of major institutions in Hokkaido. And you know that when Japanese take an interest in something, they do it with great deal of following, and I think that this is going to bode very well for the state of Alaska, and we are hoping that an event like this will capture the interest of the legislature, and that in doing so, we will be better poised to evaluate our Pacific Rim initiatives.
How soon do you need to know from us? You asked if we had specific concerns that you wanted to address. How soon do you need to know?
Well, I can fit with your timetable. Of course, we'd like to know as soon as possible, but we understand that you have a lot of pending business. But if you could give us some indication as to what you think might be important items for consideration, we'd like to include those.
Well,
let me just make a couple comments.
Can I
take Gary? First a question. When you were speaking of a guest speaker that you think we may like to see there, what kind of person are you referring to? I know you're looking for ideas for us. What ideas, what kinds of things that do you think that we should be looking for in a guest speaker?
I see. The two that we've secured so far are very influential academics. The first fellow, Professor Ryuzo Sato, is in addition to being CB Star Professor of Economics at NYU, he's also head of the U.S.-Japan Economic and Political Studies Group, and his range of contacts is very extensive, so we're hoping by inviting him here and acquainting him with Alaska, he'll be able to disseminate his impressions through his networks both in Japan and the United States. The same is true for Professor Yu, who's at Yonsei University, one of the top Korean universities, also extensive contacts in the Korean business and government sector. We're hoping that a speaker would not only have the professional credibility and the speaking skills, but would also be relatively well connected to his professional association so that he can add emphasis to and make people aware of what we're going to do in a larger sort of national audience.
Yep. Chairman, several days ago we happened to have some people here with, from the Wishbone Project who were, and I believe there was a banker with them as well.
That's right.
But they, I don't know if those are the kinds of people you're, these are people that are already making an investment in Alaska who have obviously, you know, they have connections obviously in Japan because that's where they're from, but they've already made the initial investigation into the opportunities that the state have, and they're interested in a change in our legislation so that they aren't be subject to taxation during the development stage. But these people are so committed that they're willing to go ahead even though the change in that form of taxation hasn't taken place yet. So I don't know if those are the kinds of people you're talking about, but they're already committed to investing in Alaska, and they've sort of looked at the kind of the roadmap of Alaska already. Anyways, I don't know if that was the kinds of people you were interested in or thinking about, but it was kind of interesting while we were in that meeting,
Representative Foster invited somebody from Savonga in here, who, one of the local Savonga people, who was starting to do preliminary work towards marketing seaweed in Japan. And so it's kind of interesting that this Eskimo man, who was kind of doing the first initial phases of trying to market his products, and met up with someone that's investing in a lot. So it was kind of a nice exchange. Anyway, I just thought I'd ask, because I was kind of interested in what kinds of speakers, and you're, some of these people are academians, and I was wondering if that's the kind of target people you're looking at, or you're also interested in people that are already making investment in a lot. Thank you.
We were wondering, in response, if there is a policy issue which you felt would be well served by having broader discussion, you may be in a position to identify some professional expertise in that area and bring them here in the context of the conference. Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, I don't feel that I'm doing justice to my colleagues. I've given you my perspective for the conference and some of the motivations and goals for it, but I'd also like to see that Mr. Anderson and Mr. Knight have an opportunity to address the committee and maybe share some of their
opinions. I thought Gary's been doing a fine job so far. I'm essentially the administrator of the conference, and it's my goal to see that the guests that we have from Hokkaido are welcome, and welcome very graciously. Community of Juneau has jumped into the welcome effort, and we'll be doing that. There are a number of receptions and the like to which legislators will be invited, and of course, certainly to the conference itself. Just to add to some of what Gary has been talking about, one of the hazards with any type of conference sponsored by a university is the perception that it is an academic conference. We are not trying to do that. We are trying to make this a policy conference, one that addresses issues to what it takes to do business within a community. We've styled this particular conference a conference on northern development because both Hokkaido and Alaska are northern climates. We also feel very good about this particular conference because I understand the governor has stated as one of his goals the holding of the third Northern Regions Conference between Canada, Japan, and Alaska in Anchorage in September of 1990. Again, it's an exploration of policy and development issues in northern climates, which is just starting to be explored. As far as the speakers, in trying to understand from the questions what you were looking for from us. We do have academics who happen to be extremely well connected in the business community. And in Japan, academics are viewed a little bit differently than they are here, although that perception is changing in the United States. Academics are sought after to serve as major advisors to Japanese corporations. They are sought after as suppliers of talent through their students to corporations. The academics that we have coming are individuals who have been very involved in both policy issues and involved with their corporations. And it would be nice to find individuals within the state of Alaska who do that. And I believe we have a considerable number, and we've asked quite a few, but again, busy schedules have prevented their accepting, just as it has with the Japanese. So if you have suggestions on individuals who have a good background in policy development, public speaking and business. That's the type of individual, action-oriented, somewhat futuristic in their viewpoints, and able to express that.
Mr. Anderson, I know in the past some legislators have been horrified when we posted some of our visiting foreign guests, Japanese, Chinese people, here in the Capitol, because, and I think our mistake in the past may have been not having one single individual who was knowledgeable in protocol and responsible for that. Do you have someone who's experienced and will be solely responsible for all of the niceties and things that go into hosting foreign visitors? I'm sure. I just wanted to see what arrangements you've made along those lines.
Okay, we're very fortunate in having John and Christy Gisford associates, as well as Tommy Stewart. Don Dickey has had some experience. Dr. Andrew spent a year in Japan and has some experience. And we also have at least one Japanese-born individual living in Juneau who has quite a few contacts over.
We've relied on that group as well as a number of other individuals, including staffers from legislators, to prepare for the arrival of the guests. It's taking care of absolutely everything from the time they set foot on the plane in Japan until they leave the state of Alaska once again. We've gone so deep as to consider things like signage, in the foreign countries, so their language, so that they understand where to go and what to do. We have interpreters coming in, as well as community individuals will be interpreting. Don is working on a dinner in the home for us with the three Rotary Clubs located in Juneau. We have a reception at the governor's mansion. They'll be welcomed with a fruit basket in their hotel room. We'll have an individual at the hotel who I believe will be speaking Japanese so that if they have questions, they can be answered right then. There are tours. They won't have a moment that will not be filled with activity, and one that we hope will conform to how they're being treated in Japan. So I think we've done a pretty good job on that. Dr. Sharon Cook has been responsible for the overall coordination of the hospitality effort. And we recall there were something like 15 people involved in the committee making sure that the hospitality would be taken care of.
Sounds like you're well prepared.
Well, I just want to say I appreciate the extensive work that you've done to go that route. I've heard they've gone to the extent that they told the hotel that they have to hire a bellman because the Japanese people are accustomed to a bellman coming when they come to a hotel. So it sounds like you've been very thorough. Mm-hmm.
Certainly sounds like, I'd like to note that Representative Davidson is here joining us.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. You know, I've been looking through this this agenda, the program that you have here, and one name pops out to me that you might want to consider, and that's Glenn Olds. Dr. Glenn Olds is, in my opinion, one of the closest folks to the development and the cross-cultural exchanges and training, and of course he's involved in something very exciting at the moment, which would make him, I think, very pertinent. But I would strongly suggest you consider him.
That's an excellent suggestion.
I was going to say, I have to concur with you on that as a former professor of mine.
You know, I know that he's working for a foundation in Michigan now. What would you propose as an appropriate topic for him to speak on if he's available?
I think Pacific Rim trade and cultural development or something like that, but something like that is it. I've heard him speak so many times and I get fascinated just listening, so I'm sure he could help you.
Actually, he just called me yesterday and I haven't returned his call. He's a hard guy to catch, so I've got his phone number if you need it.
Okay.
Davidson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it would be appropriate for Dr. Olds to address some kind of intermediate cultural topic that involves education and cultural exchange. I know he has a very good grasp of where he sees Alaska going as regards to Alaska's future and its relationship with the Pacific Rim. I think it's an excellent suggestion.
There's one other, and it might be interesting, I don't know. Bob Hennings, who is the editor of the Alaska Magazine, a few years back had this fantastic idea of developing a sort of a cultural trade center in Anchorage, and it was going to be literally the whole northern Pacific Rim, and there would be space inside there for the Soviets and for the Japanese and Koreans and Alaskans and everybody else, that would become a major center. And he was going to, at one time, was trying to raise money for that. I don't know if he still is or not, but it was going to be up on the campus of APU, and it might be interesting just to check with him and see if there's any further action on that whole thing.
Well, this is something I've been thinking about too after being in Hokkaido and visiting the Northern Region Center, that, and I've had some discussions with some people about the need to have some kind of a organizational structure which would allow all these different people coming over here to kind of have some coordination, because there is a lot of travel now between countries. I don't know if you noticed, but in Fairbanks, in a couple of days, we'll have some people arriving from Hokkaido and from Heilongjiang to participate in the carving exhibition. And we also have the Eskimo dancers coming from the Magadan region will be arriving up there, not in conjunction with any of this, anything else, but they'll be arriving, they'll be participating with Eskimo Native Art. So there's a lot of different things going on all the time, and it's hard for any one individual or individuals or organizations to know that and to access that. I'd like to talk more about that Northern Region Center, but if I could, I'd like to just talk a little bit about what you said about Hokkaido's experience. A group of us anyway, went up to this place called Mombets, which is it's a fishing village, and it was cut off from its access to Alaska's fish, and as a result of that, they had to get into other means and methods of getting fish, and by that I mean they went into bottom fishery, so they opened up some of these sereni plants. They had to start fish farms. So and I don't know, I'm not real familiar with the Hokkaido Society as a whole, but I think the Hokkaido Society as a whole had to change quite a bit with the 200-mile limit and the change in the fisheries in Alaska. So I think what Dr. Andrews indicated is they went through a major change in their economy and restructure their economy, and I think there's a real lesson to be learned for Alaska, given the fact that we're going to have to restructure our economy with the downturn in oil. So I think there are some lessons to be learned.
Thank you, Mr. Davidson. If any of the members have additional names that they want to refer to Dr. Gary Anders, I'd appreciate if you could either get into us or refer to him directly with those names. I'd like to provide some time now for Doug, if you want to, just if he works for us.
That's I think that the Dutch can talk about this from the standpoint of the student involvement and the value of the educational experience, because I've involved the students in my international business class directly in helping to work through some of the details in the conference.
Thank you. And it's Dutch.
Sorry about that.
As a student, I'm at the point of realization, and have been for some time, I guess, now that I realize how important international business is to the state of Alaska, and I'm sure that you as legislators do too. This conference provides, I think, a real opportunity for Alaskans to get together with the Japanese and start a relationship. I don't think that we can hope for much more than that, but I think it provides the facility or facilitates that initial part of it. And the concern I have at this point as a student is that I'm coming to the understanding that we as a country and we as a state really are not as prepared to do business with the Japanese or many of the other nations as they are with us. And I don't know what you as a legislator can do or what your interests are, but we have a lot of catching up to do. I would have to reiterate what Mr. Anderson said, and the fact that I think the gentlemen involved with this conference have done a very professional job of preparing it. I think it will be a well-attended conference, and I would hope that you would find the time to attend and participate.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Dutch? I'll make sure you're right. If not, I think probably wrap up this portion of it. I sure appreciate you coming here. We look forward to the conference. We'll probably all be there.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate your time. And thanks for the great suggestions.
Thanks, by the way. Did you have a question?
No, just not a question. I know Judy, Christy Gisberg is going to have a session. I don't know if it's a joint session or if it's just a session with the it is a joint session to teach protocol for the upcoming session to members of the legislature that are interested in learning. So I know that we're trying to do our part too. So
great.
Excellent.
Thank you very much.
I would publish them. That would be really interesting in the newspaper. I bet you they'd even carry it on.
protocol for visiting Japanese.
Yeah, that's, I think that's a good idea.
Well, next we're going to hear from someone from Senator Rick Neely's office. The senator's here.
He's on his way down.
Okay.
Probably just.
We have a few minutes for here. Committee substitute the Senator at Resolution 15. Relating to the support of bilateral aviation agreements.
And I would like to make a quick presentation.
Right.
Okay. If we can just wait for a couple of minutes.
He doesn't make it a second.
I guess I can sit down at the long table for where we want. I guess you're considering the resolution in support of the state and federal effort to improve Alaska's opportunities in the international airport system. I've had the opportunity of working with the airport system and trying to come up with ideas and trying to get destination tourism for Alaska and for the system so that we can get more tourists from Japan and other places into Alaska. One of the impediments to that has been the bilateral agreements and how it's being negotiated at the federal level. The resolution essentially sends a message to the Department of State to continue on negotiations so that we can get landing rights for carriers coming into Anchorage and into the system itself. Basically, one of the problems has been the fact that we're going to have overflights going on in the airport there, and that's going to directly affect our revenue, which is what we, which essentially runs the airport system itself. So it's a very critical issue, one that we have to be on top of. I believe Mr. Meyerhoff is also here, and he has been working very aggressively in trying to not only market our airport system through the Federal Express program and other air freight and also passenger service into the airport. Also, Gina Marie Lindsay has been working, I know she was in Washington, D.C., trying to work with Senator Murkowski's office and Senator Stevens' office to monitor what's happening on the bilateral agreements. Those are ongoing agreements which are going on this year, and that's why we thought it was appropriate to have a message continue to them. I served as the chairman of the International Trade Committee, and we saw that Alaska was just in competition with, when we went to Tokyo and we went to Japan, we found that Alaska was just like a third world country. It was a spot on the map in competition, Anchorage in particular, and Fairbanks with Portland, Seattle, San Francisco, and Los Angeles as gateway cities going to the Far East. So we hope that this, we're just essentially sending a strong message to our federal counterparts.
I have a question. Is the thrust of what you're doing here is to make Anchorage more of a destination to see from their flight over it?
Essentially, that's it. And there was, for a while there, and I don't know if, I know Betty Cato and others have followed the DOT marketing group that's been trying to market our airport system, and it took about a year and a half to get the committee off the ground. I think Fairbanks and Anchorage now have been working together pretty effectively. That was an impediment at one time.
Senator Yulia, I'm glad you brought this before the committee. I just wanted to ask if you think, are there any indications out there that state departments are not doing all the things possible currently to promote our interests in bilateral agreements? What your further resolve on page two, or are there any reasons to think that the ongoing negotiations over bilateral agreements are, I mean, have they broken down, or are there any reason to think that we're going to hit some snags? Or,
well, I think they have hit some snags, and I can't, I can just recall the one that we had, and this goes into the negotiations with all of our imbalances of trades, trade with Japan and so on, having to do with the Flying Tiger question. Kind of thing that they do with these other countries, because we're in competition with landing rights with all these other international airports throughout the world, and even the congressional delegation, United States senators, congressmen, and so on, don't really, aren't allowed into some of the meetings. So I know it's a very touchy kind of subject from that standpoint.
Mr. Meyerhoff, did you have something to answer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of things.
we're working the Alaska International Airport system, which in terms of creating opportunity for Alaska, not just for Anchorage, because it's a system and it really opens up access for the entire state. The reason why this particular resolution is so important is that the Department of State is very clear to us, the state of Alaska, that the process of bilateral treaties is a very political one. They're very upfront with us saying it's very political, and it's political pressure which moves the U.S. Department of State and the U.S. Department of Transportation to take certain positions. And one example that Senator Ewing mentioned a little earlier is this example of Alaska being a gateway. In the past, cities or airports themselves are designated as the gateways, and one of the things that through our political pressure, combined political pressure of the Cooper administration and Senator Stevens, Senator Murkowski's office, and Don Young's office, we've been able to push the Department of State to represent Alaska in these bilateral negotiations as opposed to Anchorage or Fairbanks, which increases opportunity. The point I guess I would like to make is that air routes are like interstate highways. But it doesn't cost you millions of dollars to build them. But it does take the commitment of generally a private carrier to fly them. Without the bilateral route negotiated, without it sitting there, without having it, you have no route, you have no interstate highway. And what this resolution does is it sends a very strong signal, not only to our congressional delegation, which would like it as support, it sends a very strong signal to the Bush administration and to the State Department, the U.S. Department of Transportation, that the state of Alaska is in this as a player, not just as they've been for many, many years, watching and sort of just letting it happen. I mean, we have recognized now the importance of the bilateral negotiating process, and we are learning increasingly how to be effective in that process, and this is a very important step in that process.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I noted, Senator, that there are some changes in the prior resolution to this resolution, which I assume that's just cleanup language, but it seems to me that the strongest message we send is not to our own state departments, but to the department, U.S. Department of State and Department of Transportation. So it seems like the resolve should be reversed here. Your final resolve should be to not to our department, but to the departments of state. To me, that seems a much stronger message. I don't know. That's maybe it's just semantics, but
Whatever your pleasure.
Just an observation,
Representative.
This is, the first resolution I worked on that is addressed to both the legislature as well as the Congress, or other people. I guess. I mean, it seems to me. I believe that Representative Davis's point well taken. The other question I had, Mr. Chairman, was we use almost generic terms here in terms of, support Alaska's efforts, advance Alaska's interests, and what my question is, would it be more forceful, or would it be perhaps better if we were project-specific on these resolutions? Are there specific efforts that we're trying to target? Are there specific interests that we should direct these resolutions toward?
Well, Paul, did you want to?
I guess my response is no. I think leaving it generic is a lot more effective in this case, because bilateral issues sometimes come up just like that. And if you target this on one or two, for example, the Japanese negotiations or the China negotiations, for example, last week in Anchorage we had the Deputy Director General of Air Portugal, and he's the general manager of the Pacific Basin Expansion Plan for TAP Air Portugal. And they have indicated that they've got rights now into Tokyo's Narita, and they intend to start flying that route from Portugal, Lisbon to Anchorage, Anchorage to Tokyo, Tokyo to Hong Kong. And that they intend to fly that route beginning in about 16 months, that they would like our help in the bilaterals, but they're not so sure they need them. But they want us to be aware, and they're willing to make a commitment, a very large block of seats available for Lisbon to Anchorage, for Tokyo to Anchorage, which is one of our primary objectives. Mm-hmm. So if we were to include them in there, it may not be what they want. Yet, if, they're saying, gee, we can do a good job, but if we need your help, we're going to call. So leaving it generic is something that they can use, that we can use, that our senators in Washington can use.
Do you know if the state, in fact, sends people, I think it's to IATA, the International Airline Transport Association meetings?
Yes.
You do attend them?
Yes, absolutely. And between Gina Lindsay and myself, we cover them, not 100% because there's literally hundreds of meetings they hold, but we cover the major ones, especially the ones that relate to Pacific Basin issues. And to really be specific, Gina Lindsay has covered specifically the airport side of it, and I've covered primarily the air carrier side of it. So my primary contacts are with the air carriers, and hers are with the airports. So we develop the relationships there, which then expand into the business.
And IATA's headquarters are in Montreal.
I believe they're in Geneva.
In Geneva,
Switzerland.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Paul, are we in fact doing everything that can be done by the state? The resolve on number two, on page two, talks about the governor ensuring that all state government agencies continue to work cooperatively. Is that in fact occurring?
Given the current finances that the state has, yes. Yes, I mean, if we had $10 million or $50 billion, or if we had a lot more money, I could say no if we had a surplus. But in fact, given the resources we have today, I think we're doing a pretty darn good job.
What's interesting about it is that, you know, like 2 or 3 years ago, there wasn't that much interest with the Department of Transportation, and even on the Federal Express thing, even though there's a lot of other people that wanted to take the credit for it, I mean, they've been working real aggressively to get people into the airport system to bring money into the state and tourism and everything else. And I saw it before, they didn't have this in place and they weren't working actively on it, and they made some real headroads on it because before the department didn't do anything. It took just 2 years in the Cooper administration to get to this point. And there's all kinds of other things that are going on too. I mean, you know, internationally that there's this Korean trade fair thing that's going on. There's just so many things that they've been working pretty hard on. And I think it's real interesting because both the United States senators in Washington, D.C., I went and asked them, I said, well, how is the DOT people doing at airport marketing and everything? And they even said, both Murkowski and Stevens said that they were working very closely with the Cooper administration. It was one of the things that they, you know, they agreed with them on fully and 100% and everything.
Excellent. Any more questions for Ms. Tachimini or
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, just for Mr. Meyerhoff, maybe we may not have time today, but I'm very interested in the announcement I read about in the paper about the connection between Anchorage and Lisbon and Anchorage and Tokyo, and just all the I think I know what that means, but maybe we can discuss that in a way all the ramifications.
We have a ton of things going on.
My constituents want to know, you know, I've approached this thing from the aspect of, you know, getting people to Anchorage as a destination. My constituents are concerned about whether there will be cheaper airfares to Europe, so.
The answer to that is no. Mm-hmm. The international airfares are set by IATA, and they're basically regulated and not deregulated. So unless IATA makes inroads, the answer is that's something that we probably could have almost no impact on.
Thank you.
Well, if there are no further questions, thank you for Mr. Meyer for appreciate your time. And we give a motion at this time.
Chairman, I'd like to switch these resolve clauses around just to make sure that the department's state is in the final resolve. I'd move that National Center.
Are there any objections? We'll go ahead and switch those around.
I see what you're saying, Mike.
Okay.
Chairman, you entertain a motion to move the bill? I'd move that we pass SJR 15 out with individual recommendations.
No objections? There are no objections to that. Passed out. Many members of mine have 15 minutes, so I think we could probably get through HDR 27. Is that?
I've got to go through.
Oh, well, carry on. HDR 27 over till a later date. I'm not exactly sure when, sometime before the 23rd. we'll hear that on evidence. But thanks for coming.
Any calculation with any of the investments of the project, and that they'll pay, the users are going to pay 100% of the M&O. So there's no going back to the legislature and to the loan committee and to the general fund saying, hey, I need an appropriation for M&O from the project. Five, the restatement that it's a public facility. Six, just sets out their payment schedule. Oh, no, I lied. I've got to explain six.
This statement is what they
call it. Oh, okay. what six says is there is approximately $9 million that Kaminko has expended on this project that if they had not expended the funds, I would have had to. Now, we view the road in the port as being owned by the state of Alaska through ADA. Therefore, if Kaminko hadn't spent this money, we would have had to have spent it. And it includes things like engineering, environmental impact statement, design work, geotechnical data, et cetera, et cetera. What six says is, hey, we're going to pay you back for these sunk costs, but we're not going to pay you back until the project's placed in service, and then an interest will start accruing on that, say, $9 million from that date forward. And the reason $9 million is not included in here is we want the right to audit those costs because we don't know if they're $9 million. We are not going to reimburse Kaminko for any costs they incur, say, at their mine site or any of that, only sunk costs they have related to the road and the port.
So they're basically, when the first payment comes due, when they have to start paying it, they're going to get it set off until it's $9 million plus 6.5% interest.
That's true, but it won't be set off. We'll actually trade checks, and you'll see why in about two items down from there. Seven, we talk about credit enhancement, which I was just starting to get into. We believe that it will be necessary to provide credit enhancement on the bonds, but the important part here, and this is one of the things that I believe held up negotiations for too long, the paper you have in front of you probably has two very important things in it. The first was number one, what's the rate of return the state's going to get? 6.5. And item 7 is the next one, and that basically says that we are not willing to make Kaminko a unsecured contract. We believe by the time this project is placed in service, between construction cost, administration, overhead, and capitalized interest, we'll be approaching $185 million. We believe that we needed something more than Kaminko Limited's promise to pay. What we have here, Mr. Chairman, is that we are making Kaminko go find an acceptable financial institution, and we are making that acceptable financial institution provide us with an irrevocable letter of credit on the first 10 minimum annual assessments. Let me explain what a minimum annual assessment is. It's basically the hell or high water contract I spoke about. And just to put it in relative dollar terms, if the investment base were about $185 million, the minimum annual assessment would equate to about $12.5 million. So we are going to make Kaminko go out, find an acceptable financial institution, and guarantee 10 minimum annual assessments of, quote, $12.5 million. Now, we won't know if it's exactly $12.5 million until we exactly know the investment base. We won't know that until the project placed in service. As a little explanation, I wanted more. I asked for 20. We negotiated, 10 was the best I could do it. It's there because I don't think we should enter into this project in an unsecured basis. We want third-party security. The form of security, what we wanted, was basically a letter of credit from an acceptable financial institution.
So from Kaminko's point, they're going to have to put their debt capability, whatever that is, online to guarantee the project on the loan side of it, plus on top of whatever debt financing or capitalization to build the mine itself.
That's correct. Basically, what this does is make a financial institution do an analysis of the project, of Kaminko as a corporation, and basically of the future of zinc, I believe, all three of which I don't think I'm qualified to do, and this way it's probably going to be Toronto, Dominion, or the Royal Bank of Canada is going to have to do it. Domenico's going to have to satisfy them, and they'll have a reimbursement agreement with that bank.
So you're going to get the letter of credit from Domenico Canada?
The letter of credit will come from a acceptable bank. It's going to be a bank LC. LCs are always secured by reimbursement agreements, and that will be between Cominco and the XYZ Bank.
Okay.
This basically says that as long as, for 50 years, Cominco won't be in worse shape than anyone else who'd be shipping lead zinc concentrate. Nine is important, it's short. A big fight over toll fees. Cominco basically wanted some advantage of additional toll fees. We said, hey, additional toll fees should accrue 100% to the state. And this is basically the way the state gets our money back, is through additional toll fees. Ten.
Well, do we get any more than our money back?
Yes, your money plus your rate of return.
Mr. Chairman. Is there anything beyond that?
Well,
it's just that your rate of return continues to get better.
Oh, yeah. If you get additional users, we start looking real smart.
But Cominco's protection is here is that you're not going to get an additional user and give them a lower toll fee. They're going to entice them to come up front.
Yeah, that's what worried Cominco is. See, to do this project, to be able to bond it, I've got to make Cominco sign this 50-year contract that really sticks in their throat when they're afraid that Miranda might come up 4 years from now and be able to ship just on a unit basis and not have to guarantee a minimum. And so they wanted to make sure that on a per unit basis, they would not be the firm that was on the hook for 50 years and had basically allowed a project to be built that their competitor could use cheaper. And we felt it was a legitimate request. 10 is almost a quote from the statute that says, hey, Cominco, if we start building this road in port and you decide to tube the project, you're going to repay us everything we've spent plus interest. 11 is a zinc price escalator that basically says if the price of zinc moves above a certain level, we will get to participate in that price increase. And number 12 is a very complicated provision, Mr. Chairman. What it says is, hey, after the bonds have been paid off, or 35 years, whichever is earlier, if the state has received a 6.5% return on its project, we will basically give Cominco some room that if economic conditions exist to allow them not to pay their full minimum annual assessment, but to pay basically on a unit cost so long as we are receiving our 6.5% rate of return. The rationale for this, Mr. Chairman, is Cominco very well may want to ship larger volumes in earlier years, and we would accordingly make more money. Their minimum annual assessment will guarantee them to ship something on the order of 700,000 tons. If they ship 800,000 tons, I get more money. And if they did that in the early years and our debt were then paid off, we would basically give them benefit for the money we had received in the earlier years through the mechanics of item 12, but only to the extent that we've received 6.5% rate of return.
So basically, if we could get our 6.5% rate of return under a scenario here, get that back, and then let them run down the road free.
Not free, on a unit cost basis.
Per unit.
X dollars per ton.
$0 per ton.
Oh no, no one gets to use this facility for 0 per ton, Mr. Chairman.
A dollar a ton. I mean, what we're getting at here is that after the state gets a 6.5% returned back, this provision here allows a renegotiation of the toll rate.
No, Mr. Chairman. This provision allows that as long as we've gotten 6.5% rate of return, we won't hold them on the hook for that $12.5 million minimum annual assessment. Will basically let them ship on a unit cost. And let me tell you how
if they want to shut the mine down.
And we've gotten 6.5%?
We've got a 6.5% return back, even though it's only 35 years out, they're not obligated to pay any money.
You are correct, Mr. Chairman.
operate the mine, but they don't want to pay the minimum annual assessment, which let's just say it's 12 or whatever tax number they want to do for less, they can come in and renegotiate under this here for a lower unit cost.
Yeah, the unit cost will be determined at the time the asset's placed in service. So I don't believe they could come in and renegotiate, but they could come in and basically say, we're just going to ship 300,000 ton at $10 a ton. And let me can I tell you how we get to the unit cost?
So, okay, they could show up a lower amount of
tonnage
at the same unit cost.
Correct.
And therefore pay the state less than minimum annual assessment, and
correct,
that would be acceptable.
Correct.
That's what you're saying. It's not saying they can go and change the unit cost.
Correct. The unit cost would basically be determined by the investment base resulting in a minimum annual assessment based upon allowable base throughput of the mill, of the original mill.
Okay, so prior to this clause here coming in, they pay the minimum annual assessment whether they get 100,000 or tons or a million tons.
You're basically correct to the extent.
Except they have to pay more.
More if they get a, that's correct.
Okay. So we get more money on the high end, they got to pay the same on the low end.
If they ship 1 ton, they still owe me $12.5 million a year.
And for the first 10 years, you have a letter of credit to go collect again.
Correct.
Even if they ship 0 ton.
Correct. And this, Mr. Chairman, just took 6 months.
Well, that's through the end of it. So I'm going to go back and clarify what no interest to be imputed on the equity portion on item two. So I understand what the debt in equity issue is here. In terms of the debt, you're saying you've got to go get $130-$149 of debt.
We anticipate it'll be about $100 to $110 million, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. And that, they're going, somebody has to pay the interest on that from time to get money.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
And that's going to be paid through the income stream off of this.
Yeah.
But that, I'm trying to figure out what's equity and what's debt here, so I can understand when you say you're going to pay no interest on the imputed. No interest imputed on the equity infusion prior to the date placed in service. What is the equity infusion expected to be?
Equity infusion will be cash which ADA puts into the project that comes from the Economic Development Fund, which would basically be throw off of the loans.
Okay. What's that number?
That number, we believe. Yeah, it's going to be in the neighborhood, I believe, of about $55 million. Now, interest on debt, they get nailed for that because that's treated as capitalized interest, Mr. Chairman, and it's just added in the investment base. It just ups the price tag of the project. It just moves it up.
Okay, so but basically this is that $40 or $50 million, there's no interest in accruing that until the system is put in place.
That's correct.
And then there will be a minimum 6.5%.
Correct.
What happens to this economic development fund if Minco decides that the $35 for zinc right now is not economically reason to go ahead? In other words, what happens if the project goes on hold for a couple of years?
New elementary school somewhere?
Hmm?
New elementary school?
We have $130 million in loans, $24 million cash in the economic development fund. Loan stream out of the cash stream off the loans is coming into that fund. What happens to that fund, economic development fund, if Minco says we want to wait 2 years?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, it would basically sit there, and I would envision that somewhere in the legislature they would hold a hearing, and I would be come down and basically ask the same question. My answer would be, you told me through law that you wanted me to proceed with the Long Mountain Transportation Project. The project's been put off for 24 months because zinc's in the tank. And it would basically, the legislature would have to decide whether they wanted to let the money sit there or whether they wanted to do something else with it.
Do you have any other projects pending that would use the economic development process?
No, Mr. Chairman, I do not. And if I come up with any by law, you're required to approve them before I can enter into them. That's true. That's for a revenue bond, Mr. Chairman. But for own and operate, you're required to approve any project. I tried for the 50, and you wouldn't let it go by. You're called. No, no. It's just my son's 7, and it's a lot of overcrowding in South Anchorage. No, no. I have received phone calls, though. So. Yes, I have.
Would you know what? Do you know what Cominco's decision-making time frame is on this contract? I mean, can this letter of agreement here basically just float around on it tonight, or is this a deadline to say yes or no on it?
No, Mr. Chairman, we've told Cominco that if we don't have a binding contract in place by 12/31, we will cease all expenditures on the project. And our expenditures aren't massive, but we're spending, there's some design work, there's engineering work, there's acquisition of right-of-way work going on. And if Cominco hasn't moved and isn't willing to entertain an approval of the contract before their board by the end of the year, we're going to cease making expenditures from our funds. And I don't know where we would go from there. If the project's going to move forward on the timetable that we project, Mr. Chairman, which is a summer of 86 construction start, I must be in the debt markets no later than March to have funds to award a construction contract so the contractor can mob in and make the sea lift up there in summer of 86. So if we don't have a contract by the end of December, the first part of January, the project's been delayed a year.
The first part of my question. Do these terms stay in existence after that date? I mean, is this an agreement that you're willing to sit with for a year or two while they, Cominco analyzes it, or do you go back, you pull this back off the table?
Oh, no, Mr. Chairman. They come through and sign the contract by 12/31, or we start all over. That's my perception. Now, I'm just one of three on the negotiating committee. There's Riley Schnell and Terry Elder or others, but my feeling would be, If they take this to the board and the board turns it down, I'm not sure what my reaction is going to be. I would certainly have to go back to the ADA board because the ADA board ratified it. I just would have to dwell on that a little bit. I'm not quite sure where we'd go from there. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. This is probably, in recent history, the worst time of the year to entertain the major metals development. The London Metals Exchange has basically tubed, especially the tin side. Zinc is in the tank. I think it's 35, 38 cents a pound. Cominco is having production cutbacks. I think all of the zinc producers are. Cominco, I believe, did lose $28 million last quarter. It's a tough time. But what's important here is not the price of zinc today, but the price of zinc in 1990, when the mine goes in operation. And that's something that I'm unqualified to say what the price is. What gives me an indicator is that Cominco has indicated they're willing to sign this agreement. They're willing to go forward and sign a contract to start the process moving forward. So just my own thinking, for what it's worth, would be their economists must think there's
so they're cut back now would be, I think, not signed.
I think their cut back now has caused them much consternation and consideration at high levels of the company of this agreement. But on Wednesday, Bob Stone, their VP of Finance, told me that they were willing to sign. Now, I believe that there's been a lot of agony within their corporation on whether they should or not. All right. So we sign a. This results in a contract. Cominco signs the contract. Now, then it's important to think of when they basically say, "Oops, changed our mind. We don't want to do the deal." I guess that's basically what we're moving towards. When Cominco says, "Oops, changed our mind. We don't want to do the deal," they are responsible for all of the costs we have incurred plus interest from the time they notify us of that. So if they sign a contract and then say, oops, before we're out on the street with a construction contract, they can probably walk away fairly cheaply in relative terms. Now, if I'm out on the street with a contract, and if I've awarded a contract to a contractor to build a road and port, and then they come running up and say, oops, sorry guys, it was just, it was a good idea, but it's not going to work out, we changed our mind, they're talking serious financial obligations, because I have a hunch the contractor's going to come around and write me a letter and say, hey partner, I put a lot of time and effort into that money, into that project, I bid it, I would have made this much profits. So basically, Cominco's on the hook for that. I think Cominco is definitely going to have to make their gut call, I mean their final determination, from a financial exposure point of view, before that contract, before the construction contract is awarded. That's correct.
Or if they delay, what if it's delayed at that point? Then
delay doesn't bother me, because I'm going to go ahead, I'm going to bill that road and port per the contract specs I put out. Come July 1, 1990, I expect to get paid. If they don't pay, I go to the Royal Montreal Bank or, and I present my LC and ask for my $12.5 million.
Per year?
Per year.
Get
for 10 years. Ah, good question, sir. All right.
Put a resort.
After 10 years, I've received, and let's say the 12.5 is the right number, I've received about $125 million. Now, I've got more than that into the project when I consider all of my construction costs and my interest during construction, et cetera, et cetera. So Cominco still owes me some money, and at that time we would demand payment from Cominco, and if Cominco didn't pay, we'd sue them, and we would have to sue them probably in a Canadian court, sue them for every dime they owed us. So we're basically secured for $125 million, and we basically have a contractual IOU for the differential. That Charter Oil we discussed during our negotiation sessions.
Well, actually, we could get that in 10 years. The total amount you would put in the development would be $158 million.
That's construction cost. $185 million would be our total investment in the project. That's construction costs plus admin plus interest during construction.
We could end up owing that $6 million.
That's correct.
That's just nominal.
We're not inflating anything. We're
not inflating. Okay, we're just kind of running a little short here. I wanted a point three on the bill that passed. I think we've covered all the rest of them. Is the Nanocorp sale lease for land and access to gravel? Where are you on that?
We held our first negotiation session with Nana, and basically what we did was both parties left the table and said, we will get back together when we see what Cominco is going to do. I just heard from Cominco on Wednesday, so I would envision that we would soon be getting back together with Nana. We have appointed a group to negotiate a land and gravel arrangement with Nana. That consists of Henry Springer out of DOT, Riley Schnell, and myself. And I chair that committee, Mr. Chairman.
So you're still in negotiations with Nana, and on the two items, one is the lease, the right-of-way, and
right, the surface estate and sand and gravel.
I just, we started a couple of minutes late here. I just want to run back on your ADA thing. Your average loan, I think you said, was $490,000 with zero as a minimum, $10 million as a top. How many of those, can you give a geographical breakdown on loans under $100,000 that you've been involved with?
Of course I could, but it would basically have to be a hand-pick type. I could do it, Mr. Chairman. I need a couple of days.
And the reason I'm asking that, and we're running a lot of time here, is that the feeling numbers you've given us here tend to argue against that, that you do get involved with loans on a smaller level. But I'm just curious to see if is that just something I'm finding in my area of the state, or is it all in Anchorage where the small loans are made?
Okay. Under 100,000, you'd like the geographic? I could have that for you in a day or two, probably. Propaganda that I'll just leave here for the committee's pleasure.
Anybody in the audience have a question? This is free-for-all here today. Anybody can participate? Yeah, all of the comments that were made about Mr. Lear, he was out of the room. Fine. Note that for the record.
You should point out the Development Authority gave him his first real job, Mr. Chairman, and trained him.
Yeah, we're gonna take 5 minutes here, so we'll find this. What time is it? 22. We'll start at 15:02. Okay, we'll bring the House Loan Committee back to order at about 10:45. And we have Ron Lear with the last House of Finance. Actually scheduled it all the way through noon, and ask you to give a short briefing of where you're at and what you're doing, and we have some questions on the issues of program.
As I mentioned, I have the two books for you, the Whole Earth Catalog and then the Legislative Briefing Book, and I will make reference to those so you can see what I'm talking about. Alaska Housing started back in 71, but the real Alaska Housing is the one that was created in 1980. Before 1980, it had a limited amount of bond issuance, low to moderate income, simply took account of the federal law. But in 1980, this is when it was opened up to basically everybody in the state. The last major change was in 1983 when they had the state veterans program. And since then, there hasn't been any new significant programs added. Just to give you an idea of the types of loans, I'm not going to go through them all, but the first tab in the briefing book has little brochures on all the various programs. I mean, we have, you know, for first-time home buyers, for veterans, you know, our conventional tackle programs, mobile home, multifamily, second mortgage. We have the HOF program, the double subsidized, all of those. I mean, we have essentially a full range of programs. We don't refinance. That's, I guess, about the only major thing that we don't do. Oh, I should mention we also have a non-conforming loan program, too, as of July. I'm not going to go into it right now, but one thing we have noticed, or at least I noticed when I went back and had a little preparation for a speech, is the relationship between the amount of new programs we have and what our volume is. As long as we don't have any new programs, our volume is relatively stable at a much lower level. As soon as we open a new program, it just takes off again. I mean, the veterans program came in, and we went from something like $800 million to $1.3 billion in 1 year, and because people all of a sudden access a new program. So, you know, to the extent that we don't add any new programs, we feel a little bit more confident in projecting what our volume will probably be in the future. Right now, we're probably doing something like around $650 million for this year, which is the lowest year since 1981, since the program really took off. But again, it's because we have a more stable set of programs, and also, of course, the market has just generally slowed down. Just to give you an idea of how big HFC is, because I didn't really realize this myself until I started going through all the various statistics, we have nearly 53,000 loans outstanding. And try to get some numbers from HUD with respect to how many actual owner-occupied units there are and what proportion we are of that. And in Anchorage, we have financing on approximately 64% of all the owner-occupied housing units. I mean, that's all of them, including some. If you take 100% of the units, some will be owned totally with no debt on them whatsoever. You know, some may have a loan from 10, 15 years ago. But if you take all the units, we have financing outstanding on about 64%. If you go statewide, our best guesstimate there is about 67%. So roughly two-thirds of the owner-occupied units you've got in the state, including some allowance for vacancy, right now have HFC financing on them. you know, if you probably took all those which were financed, you know, we'd probably be, I don't know, 75%, maybe more. The amount of outstanding financing right now is roughly $4.4 billion in loans. Almost all that is on the stick built, by the way. I know we get questions, okay, on the mobile homes. We have about $150 million worth on mobile homes out of our $4.4 billion. The amount of bonds that we have outstanding right now is about $4.5 billion. And the way I look at that, and by the way, we have right now more, an excess amount of bonds. I mean, we have basically about a year's supply in some of our tax-exempt bond programs. I can get into a little bit later why we did that. But the way I look at it is that we've brought all that money into the state that wouldn't have been here before.
Yeah,
I mean,
$4.4 billion outstanding, and you have $4.5 billion
right.
in bonds.
Because I have about a year's supply now worth of tax-exempt bonds. We basically overissued the bonds because with the federal tax law and the uncertainties of it all, you kind of want to bet a little bit on the come.
And they allow you to arbitrage a certain percentage?
Well, you always lose. I mean, what you hope to do in the arbitrage is not lose bad. So, because, you know, short-term taxable rates are maybe in the 7 to 8%, and your tax-exempt money is costing between 9 and 10, so it's not like you're making money off it. So our last one, we did quite well on. Just by way of comparison, the state appropriation, we got roughly $750 million in cash and $286 million in loans. And over that time period, we've done over $5 billion in financing, of course. I mean, the 4.4 is what's outstanding now, but a significant share has paid off. So from $1 billion roughly in total assets that the state gave us, we've done over $5 billion worth of financing, and we can continue but with that seed money, if you will.
I just want to, this is what kind of bothered me in the first place on the first number, so that the state, where is the state's money, $750 million in cash? If your outstanding loans are less than the bonds issued, where's the original equity?
Well, some of it, of course, has been used to subsidize the bonds that have been outstanding, and some of it we still have.
Okay, so basically that's been the subsidy that's used up most of that.
The subsidy is probably used, well, it's used up over half the state money. It's hard to assign it in the sense that we're a little bit different than ADA. We're not quite as clean as what ADA is. ADA got a chunk of money, which you can kind of identify, but we not only got the chunk of money, we also had certain existing programs that pay off, and we get the payoff of those programs, and they're kind of all intermingled. So it's not as clear a delineation one might like. I guess just one overall number. Since 1980, we have financed over $2.5 billion of newly constructed homes. So about half of our $5 billion has been for newly constructed. And, you know, normally I guess the skeptic says, well, some of that would have happened anyway, even without you, and that's true. But an awful lot of it wouldn't have happened without us. So if one wants to look at how whether the state got a return on its money, it's gotten a lot of construction and a lot of spending because of that original $1 billion. The way we operate, I guess it's somewhat similar to ADA. We're a secondary lender.